sound. Time to heal
all of my people,
to renew your trouble line. And everybody say, whoa, whoa.
Put your hands up.
Recovery. Say,
whoa. Well, welcome to this latest episode of the Pirate Monk Podcast, brought to you by SamsonSociety.org. I'm your host, Nate Larkin, here with special guest, Mo Leverett.
Yes.
Been in town for several days. Mm-hmm. And, of course, we're accompanied by our fearless engineer, the Reverend Mondo.
Reverend, now.
Yeah.
Yeah,
but he is not sporting the plaid shorts.
No,
he's gone with solid colors today.
But,
and a pink shirt.
But yeah, see, I thought about you this morning. I said, okay, I'm not going to bring the shorts, but I'm going to bring the pink shirt.
And you didn't mention anything about his old school Converse,
yes,
high tops.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
I tell you, it's quite an ensemble.
I'll tell you, truthfully, I did think about you this morning.
Really? Really?
Yeah, I did.
You know, I never told you the pink shirt story. My dad was an old-time Pentecostal preacher.
Okay.
A very heterosexual.
Yeah. Oh,
old-time, yes, Pentecostal,
yeah, very
preacher.
Very important.
Extremely important.
Mm-hmm.
And he was firmly of the opinion that a pink shirt, mm-hmm, put one's sexual identity in doubt.
You're right. Right.
So what are you saying to me?
Yeah. No. So
yeah.
My stepmother always told him that she would bury him in a pink shirt.
Yeah.
And in my passive aggressive days, when, yeah, I'd go home and he would invite me into the pulpit, I always made it a point to wear a pink shirt.
Yes, you did.
And preach from a Roman Catholic Bible just to bother him.
Well, we weren't Pentecostals in our household.
Yeah.
But that doctrine was well entrenched in our household.
Really?
As well. Pink is not for men.
Yeah.
But it's astonishing, though, at his funeral, she did bury him in a pink shirt.
Shut up.
And most every man who came wore a pink shirt.
Wow.
It was kind of this mark of respect. And for some reason, on that day, I could not bring myself to wear a pink shirt. I wore a white one.
Yeah. Well, I grew up in the same kind of household, though.
Did you?
So, yeah, I just recently, within the last maybe 3 years, got into every now and then.
Exploring your pastel side.
Yes, I did. But it started with, you know, suits, you know, the dress shirt with the soft pink with the,
yeah,
dress,
yeah,
shirt. It,
yeah,
started there.
Yeah, yeah.
So I just didn't just go to the pink polo. You know what I mean? I couldn't do that. But it started off with the dress shirt, and then I'm experimenting with this. So
yeah.
We'll see how it works. Mm-hmm. We'll see how it works. Mm-hmm. So far, it's kind of 50-50.
Yeah. It draws attention, doesn't,
yes, it?
That's,
does,
right.
Yeah, it does. Yes, it does.
From both sexes. Yeah. That's the problem.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it's good to have both of you guys in the same room. Mo's actually been here for a few days. Got here on Thursday.
Where are you from, Mo?
Well, that's a good question. I was born in Covington, Georgia. We moved to Trenton.
Hey, wait, I got a better idea.
Okay.
Why don't you do the song that tells him where you're from?
Most of my memories are in Georgia. All of my soul was in New Orleans. By the way of Mississippi, by the way of Tennessee, I'm proud to be a Southerner, and I'm ashamed simultaneously, if you know what I mean. Deep in my heart, I am a criminal. Deep in my bones, I am a thief. Used to cause my mama suffering. Used to give my daddy grief. When the teacher saw me coming, she would tremble like a leaf, if you know what I mean. I was a fool in the old days. Used to take life as a joke. Used to steal my mom. Mama's Winston's crooked smile while I smoked. I was a skinny boy in high school. Now I'm drinking Diet Coke, if you know what I mean. Well, you will not hear this song in Nashville. Will not play on the radio. You can go up the dial on FM and on AM to and fro. They tell me I'm a white man, but my mama, she called me Mo, if you know what I mean. Well, I was a Baptist boy in childhood, met a Lutheran girl at school, and now I am a preacher. Just the gospel's living proof. Oh Lord, I'm Presbyterian, and that's why I sing the blues, if you know what I mean.
You know, I got to tell you, looking at you, listening to you, hanging around with you a few days, it's hard for me to believe, Mo, that you are a Presbyterian.
Yeah, me too. Me too.
Now, I, on the other hand, you know, I was raised a Pentecostal, but I was kind of like internally a Presbyterian.
Uh-huh. Well, there's some similarities, actually.
Really?
Yeah, there are.
But that's good to know, because I don't want to lose my heritage.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
I feel like my Pentecostalism brings some juice to my Presbyterianism.
Uh-huh. Well, I think the focus on holiness and piety is something that is shared very much in common.
Yeah.
Between the two. The manner in which we go about it is quite different. and the tone in which we go about it is quite different.
Yeah. Well, you're in town along with, a whole boatload of Presbyterians.
Yeah, that's true.
The PCA, the Presbyterian Church in America, is holding its General Assembly in Nashville this week.
True.
Up at the Convention Center.
Right.
Going to be a big shindig at the Ryman, I think, on Wednesday or Thursday night.
Mm-hmm. Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. You'll be exhibiting and talking about Rebirth International.
Yeah, I'll be talking about my ministry called Rebirth International, which is kind of phase two for my life, because I founded Desire Street Ministries in New Orleans, Louisiana. And after Katrina, and after stabilizing the ministry as best I knew how, I resigned and started Rebirth International.
Uh-huh.
Which is an effort to advance urban ministry initiatives in pockets of poverty stateside and worldwide. And so through a number of different ministry objectives, we're pursuing phase two of my calling in urban ministry.
All right.
That's awesome.
And in the meantime, you are filling a pulpit in Florida.
That is true.
What's that like, preaching every Sunday?
I don't think that it was what I was born to do. It's been good for me on a number of different levels. Probably it has taken some of the prophetic edge and made it a little more palatable to the common everyday man, but it's been good.
I think it's good practice for prophets to take up a pastoral role now and again.
To learn what it means to shepherd and to gain an appreciation for pastors, which, while I don't feel like I am legitimately one, even though I hold the office, I have grown to appreciate and to admire those who shepherd well.
Yeah.
It is not an easy line of work.
Yeah, I agree. Mm-hmm. And so you're a Presbyterian, you're a preacher. And would you call yourself a pirate monk?
Oh, I would say I'm more a pirate monk than I am a Presbyterian.
Well, we'll get into that when we come back on the Pirate Monk Podcast.
Oh, a pirate's life is a wonderful life, a roving over the sea. Give me a career as a buccaneer, it's the life of a pirate for me. Oh, the life of a pirate for me.
And we're back. Well, before we get into your life and ministry and all of that, Mo, I'd like to share a letter. By the way, we love your letters here on the podcast. Send us your suggestions, your questions, your complaints, your polemics, anything you want to send to us.
Ideas.
Ideas for new segments.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Care packages, cookies, anything you want to send to us.
Yes, we like cookies.
Right. Hard to email the cookies, but you can email all the other things to letters at samsonsociety.org. That's letters at samsonsociety.org. No P in Samson, by the way. S-A-M-S-O-N. Okay. Got this letter from a woman. God bless our female listeners. Mm. I read your book, Nate, after my husband brought it home from a business trip. He didn't read the book. He claimed he had no idea why it was given to him. He left it on his dresser, and I put it away. Then one day, I decided to read it. I had great hope throughout the book, until I read the end. You pretty much say that you have to have a babysitter, and that just really gave me no hope for my husband. Isn't the grace of our Lord enough for someone to give this up? I can't seem to forgive my husband for this secret life of his, the secret life he lived. Thank you for the book. I really wish the ending had given me hope. But it's his life, not mine. It's so hard for me to get him to understand how much he changed through the course of our 31-year marriage. Mm. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for your honesty. I got to tell you, I was disappointed myself when I learned that my dream of independence, of a healing that I could hold on my own, was an illusion, that I was never going to get it. Mm-hmm. That's what I wanted when I came into recovery. Of course, I didn't come into my recovery until there was no other option. It was a last-ditch effort to save my marriage. To be honest, I didn't even care that much about my own life at that point because I couldn't see my own life apart from my marriage. Mm-hmm. But I just wanted to be fixed. Mm. I didn't want to join a group.
Yeah.
In fact, these guys were so messed up that I didn't want to be associated with them.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, my first thought after my first meeting was, heck, I'm leadership material. These guys are sick.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
Because a lot of them had done things I'd never done. Later on, when I began to listen for the similarities and disregard the differences, I saw that we really pretty much all had the same story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And eventually, I had to make the emotional decision to join the community, to come out of, to give up this hope. I really thought that there was, you know, I thought, because I'm by nature Presbyterian, I thought the solution was intellectual. There was some piece of the puzzle I was missing, some idea, some concept. The silver bullet is what I was looking for. Mm-hmm. And because there were guys in these rooms who had lived now, had enjoyed continuous years, many years of sobriety, their lives had turned around, and I could see in their lives what I wanted, I thought they'd found the silver bullet. And so I listened carefully, and I read all the literature, and I'm a good student. Only to discover that there is no silver bullet, except perhaps relationship, brotherhood.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, her characterization of the need in every man for relationship and accountability with other men as babysitting.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm disappointed that she sees it that way. but I understand it too, because I certainly grew up in that frame of mind as well. My father was a man's man. He was a college football player. He was a military person, and he was a strong disciplinarian. And I remember once playing midget league football, and I did a move that I may have seen maybe Walter Payton or someone like that do well. I didn't do it with as much precision and expertise. And I turned and a kid hit me with his helmet right in my midsection, mm-hmm. and knocked my breath out of me, and I fell to the ground and laid there. And the coaches ran out and told me to stay down. They started pulling on my football tugs, mm-hmm. letting me get my breath back in me. But I remember my father came from the stands, mm-hmm. walked down slowly. Mm-hmm. He was in no hurry. Mm-hmm. And when he stood over me, he said two words. I'll never forget him. He said, "Get up."
Yeah.
And I got up. And that mm-hmm. toughness, that sense of independence, that sense of personal autonomy and was a value in my household.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And as a result, I don't do relationships really well. I do relationships where others can depend on me,
right.
or come to me,
yeah.
but where I need to be vulnerable, where I lay my heart on the line, where I confess my sin,
yeah.
where I open up my heart. That's a difficult thing. But to characterize that as babysitting,
yeah.
is a misnomer.
Yeah.
And the reality is that every man, when you think about this, this is a discovery that I made some time ago. when Jesus went to the Garden of Gethsemane, mm-hmm. one of the things that's striking about that is that he brought his friends with him.
Yeah, yeah.
And he left them behind for the one thing that he had to do alone, but he asked them for prayer. And in the middle of his struggle, he came back to check with them and to perhaps gain strength from them.
Yeah.
And they were sleeping.
Yeah.
And he awakened them and said, can't you stay awake just for a little while to watch and to pray on my behalf?
Yeah.
And what that points to, and for me, is that if Jesus Christ, God incarnate, needed other men in his life,
yeah.
then who am I to stand on my own?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so mm-hmm. the writer, I understand.
Yeah.
I understand. I always thought this way too. When I was struggling with issues with pornography and as if that's in the past, the struggle persists. But
yeah.
But when it was at its height in my youthfulness, I always thought there would be a spiritual formula that I could apply, whether it be Watchman Nee,
mm-hmm.
and some kind of hidden and secret mm-hmm. spiritual depth of a life, or other books like, what's the guy's name who more in my camp, who wrote The Pursuit of Holiness, I forget his name anyway, but there all those books out there on holiness. I really thought that it was just getting to the right book. It was just getting to the right spiritual mm-hmm. principle or the biblical verse or whatever.
Yeah.
The application of grace in my life.
Yeah.
And while nobody here would be minimizing all of those things.
Oh, man. Without the grace of God, it's impossible.
Yeah. But at the same
time.
How
is his grace mediated most often, though?
Is through our brothers.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Part of her concern, she said her husband brought the book home from a business trip. That's tells me she's married to a traveling man.
Yeah.
And I say in the book that now that I'm in recovery, I never travel alone. That's not an option for every traveling man.
Right.
Mm-hmm. She may have gotten the misapprehension. She may have concluded from my story that no recovering porn addict, sex addict can ever travel alone. Interestingly, one of my favorite sponsors, my early sponsors, was himself a traveling man, traveling salesman, mm-hmm. who didn't have the option of taking anybody with him on the road. Mm-hmm. But here he told me this story, which I loved. He said, I always got in trouble on the road. Of course, that was my story too. Mm-hmm. Always got in trouble on the road. I could keep up my boundaries for a while, but eventually my resolve would fail and my car would find its way to a strip club or bookstore or whorehouse somewhere. Somehow I had this internal radar for where that stuff was, and that's how I navigated. He said, I traveled for a living, and he said, I always got in trouble when I was traveling, and I got in the most trouble in Memphis. He said, which also was where where most of my business was. He says, I had a big territory, but about 80% of my business was in Memphis. Mm. And he said, so I get a sponsor, he says, and one of the things that we're doing is I'm having to call my sponsor every day, and I'm calling him from the road. And he says, and I have a couple of slips, and both of those slips are in Memphis. So I have a conversation with my sponsor, and my sponsor tells me, brother, I don't think you can go to Memphis. He said, well, that was crazy. 80% of my business was in Memphis. My sponsor said, you want to get sober? You can't go to Memphis until I say you can go to Memphis. Mm-hmm. So all of a sudden, he had to pay attention to parts of his territory he had never paid attention to before. Because his addict always wanted to go to Memphis. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And he said there was a dip in his income as he developed the rest of his territory. But eventually, he was making as much money outside of Memphis as he'd been making in Memphis. Eventually, he got to the point where he could call his sponsor. He could drive to Memphis and drive back. And one day, he just couldn't stay over. And then after a few years, he got to the point where, with a phone call, he could actually stay in Memphis. He said, today he can go to Memphis.
But he has more recovery underneath him.
Got more recovery underneath
him. You know, one thing that I thought about, I don't want to cut you off.
Well, I just want to make the point that he didn't, that was babysitting in a way. I mean, that was, he did that relationally. Mm-hmm. He did it with the telephone.
Right.
Now, me, I'd rather just take somebody with me because the...
Yeah. Well, the one thing that I think of is about her story is somebody was reaching out to her husband.
Yeah.
We don't know the story behind that, but he got that book from someone else. It's not likely that he picked it up somewhere.
No.
Mm-hmm. And let me say this, you probably wouldn't. I will. What a cool book. And it's almost like a gospel tract for men. It's really amazing, funny, hilarious book. But there was a man on the other end of that book reaching out to her husband. And through the book, potentially building a relationship of accountability, the very thing that her husband needed.
Yeah.
And I imagine if she was negative about it towards her husband, it was like the worst thing she could have possibly done, not only for him, but for herself, because she was cutting off his lifeline.
Yeah.
That is, the lifeline really is another man reaching out who's been where he's at.
Right.
And has found the victory and found the refuge and the lifeline in relationships.
Yeah. Well, Mo, you got a big stack of songs here. I find it interesting you carry your lyrics with you on I think you must have 200 songs sitting there. He pulled that out on our front porch the other night. We had dinner. We had some folks over, and I asked him to play. And man, you just knocked us off the porch. It was so kind of you to play. And
That's cool.
I wonder, would you play us another song, something along a recovery theme?
Well, I do have a song actually called Lifeline, and
all
I'd
right.
be happy to play that one.
Do you know how it feels to lose everything or to have it all dangling by a thin little string? You're losing your mind, you've wounded your soul. You should take it as a sign if you're losing control. Do you know how it feels at the end of your rope? A weakening wheel on a slippery slope. You know it full well, you're star of the role. A vision of hell is of losing control. Somebody lend a hand, somebody throw that man, we'll throw him a lifeline while you can. Do you know how it feels to wound those you love, to wound them and then to wipe up their blood? Do you know how it feels to give up your power for vapors and mists that fade in an hour? Somebody lend a hand, somebody throw that man, we'll throw him a lifeline while you can.
Oh man, losing control feels like dying, doesn't it? Feels like
dying.
That's the hardest thing in 12-step recovery. You know, that first step is a doozy. Mm-hmm. We admitted that we were powerless over our addiction, and that life had become unmanageable. It had made our lives unmanageable. And yet somehow, surrendering to a power greater than ourselves, giving up the illusion of control, it's only in dying that we find life.
Yeah, the term that I like best in the 12-step is the term insanity. And it was the one that I probably most resisted and even rejected.
Yeah.
Because, my explanation was, I know a lot of men, and I know that almost every man that I know struggles in this area.
Yeah.
But to say that for me to really adequately deal with this issue in my life is to acknowledge my insanity was, it just felt like over the top to me. But in truth, it really was perfectly worded, because how insane is it really for you to do what does not satisfy and destroy the only things you really love in your life?
Yeah.
It's insane.
Yeah. Yeah.
What we do in terms of destroying our marriages and the trust that we have with our children.
Yeah.
Until you realize that you really are out of control.
Yeah.
You can't take another step, really.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, why don't we rewind? I'd like to let's rewind your life a little bit So you grew up, I mean, you bounced all over the South.
Yeah, well, we never finished that, but I was born in Covington. We moved to Trenton, Georgia, then to Tullahoma, Tennessee.
Oh, yeah,
then
Tullahoma. Oh, yeah.
Then to Chattanooga, Tennessee, then back to Tullahoma, and then to Macon, Georgia when I was seven.
Holy smokes.
Oh, wow.
My father was a manager for Goodyear, and their perspective was the best thing to do to maintain loyalty is to keep you from putting your roots down.
Yeah. Okay.
Loyalty to the company. And so anyway, he quit the company, which didn't help to support their whole approach to management. But he quit the company, moved back to his hometown in Macon, Georgia. And so from 7 until I was 18, those were primarily my formative years. And
that's a good music town, Macon.
It is. It is a good music town. There's a number of good musicians that came from there. Otis Redding.
Yeah.
The Allman Brothers.
Yeah.
Yep.
And Buddy Green, Mark Hurd.
There you go.
Christian music industry.
We got to get Buddy on this podcast. I'll twist one arm if you'll twist the other.
Oh, yeah. Well, if he'll play the harmonica, it'd be worth it. He's amazing. But, yeah, and I came from there, and most of the time I don't stink the place up too bad. So,
oh, come on. You got it. You're great.
Well, thanks. So anyway, I went then to college at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga, and I went there to play football. Mm-hmm. And I prayed this prayer that I regret really. My whole aspiration in life was to become a professional football player.
Yeah.
And I wasn't. I was a better than average athlete, but I was not a stellar athlete. But one thing I learned to do, and I learned to do as well as anybody, is how to punt a football. And I'd gotten very good at it. Now, looking back on it, I realize, you know, nobody respects a punter. So it wasn't really the best track, but it was the only one I had to run on. And But I prayed. I got to a point where I was punting at a level I knew I could punt at the next level. And so I prayed. I said, Lord, if you will give to me the desire of my heart, then I will use the platform that you give me to witness to the gospel. But if you want me out, make it obvious.
Yeah.
And I got specific. I said, injure my leg or something.
Yeah.
And injure it in such a way as to make it where I couldn't heal within a few months and get back on the field. Leave a mark.
Yeah.
That's the dumbest prayer I've ever prayed in my life. But God was faithful, and I injured my left hip. I tore tendons in my left hip, the same hip that Jacob tore when he wrestled with God. And so I went back home to Macon and had surgery, and I finished at Mercer University, and that's where I met my wife, Ellen.
Oh.
And we then went to seminary. I was an old Southern Baptist, and Ellen was an old Lutheran, and we went to a Presbyterian seminary, and I came out a confused evangelical. But actually, before I went to seminary, you know, I was trying to come to terms with my own Southernness. I was obviously a white guy, but had spent all my life going to integrated public schools and playing football, and always had one foot in a Southern white world and one foot in a Southern black world. My father had stereotypical views of the black community, which just didn't measure up to my sense of reality. And so my view of the South was altogether different than traditional white Southerners. And so I was an English major at Mercer University, and one of the classes that I took was a black literature course. which took me a step beyond my experience.
Yeah.
And as much as you can with a Southern white boy, it put me in the skin of the struggle from the days of slavery to the present. Mm-hmm. It was the first time I'd read Frederick Douglass and mm-hmm. W.B. Du Bois and mm-hmm. Booker T. Washington, mm-hmm. Ralph Ellison, Richard Wright, mm-hmm. James Baldwin, Langston Hughes, so on and so forth, right? And it was a heart-wrenching experience to discover that those who most resisted their Christian struggle for justice and for mm-hmm. equality and all this were white, conservative, Southern evangelical men like myself.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what all this meant for me. I just knew that in light of the grace extended to me in the gospel and the kingdom enterprise that I had committed myself to, that somehow this fit in, and I didn't know what it meant. I didn't even know what urban ministry was mm-hmm. at the time, but I had developed a passion for the other side of the gospel, the other side of the scriptures that are as plain as day, but are rarely talked about or were rarely talked about in my circles.
Mm-hmm.
The issues of justice, the issues of poverty, all those kinds of things. And so when I went to seminary, one of the first classes I took was an urban missions course, and it all came together for me mm-hmm. there. And I sensed God's call and hand on my life to go into the urban community as an ambassador of the gospel. And I was looking for the neediest neighborhood I could find. And I went all over the country visiting different works and different cities. But never did I see anything so bleak and hopeless as I did when I visited New Orleans and saw the Desire Housing Project community.
Mm.
And God grabbed a hold of my heart there in ways that He had never done before.
Mm.
And make a long story short, I spent 17 years there seeing God do what only He can do
mm.
in the lives of young men who most of society had long turned their backs on. And
yeah.
to see guys who were stealing cars and selling drugs and on the fast track to the city morgue or to Angola prison now be faithful husbands,
mm.
loving fathers,
mm.
and productive businessmen is the greatest thing my eyes have ever witnessed.
Yeah.
Wow.
Wow. And now, how old are you?
I'm 45 years old.
Mm.
Actually, I'll be... What's today?
28th.
Tomorrow, I'll be 45.
Really?
Uh-huh,
yeah. Well, you're here. Uh-huh. We're going to have to do something about that.
Yeah, let's do it.
So, did you make the pivot 3 years ago? I only ask because this crazy number 42 keeps coming up.
Hmm.
I can't tell you how many guys I talk to who are at a crisis point.
Yeah.
We're freaking 42 years old, and it takes me back. Did you ever read The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
I haven't read that book, but I've heard of it.
Yeah.
I need to get it.
I don't know. I'm not recommending it to our listeners or anything. It's just this odd thing that Douglas Adams at the end, you know, the main character is looking for the meaning of life.
Yeah.
And at the end of the life, at the end of the book, the meaning of life turns out to be
42.
Anyway, crazy.
It was around 42, but
yeah.
I don't know if it was exactly 42.
It was around 42 for me. Yeah.
Well, and Ellen and I had pursued counseling.
Yeah.
Because of my inability to deal with pornography, and to overcome that whole temptation. So we went to a counseling center, and I resisted identifying my behavioral patterns as addiction. I just thought I was dealing with what every man deals with,
right.
But everything I had attempted, everything that I had read, didn't work.
Yeah,
and it wasn't until my behavior was identified as addictive behavior that I began to began to get the tools necessary to begin to deal with that behavior. And I thought, honestly, that was the beginning of a new life for me.
Yeah.
And a life of hope and promise and so on and so forth. And I found a year and a half later, still sober, that I had a lot more to deal with.
Yeah.
I had a lot more to deal with. And of course, God brought the perfect storm in my life, into my life. Some call it Katrina, but it was actually a confluence of Katrina and many other things.
Yeah.
But I was running a ministry with over 60 staff members and in a place that had been devastated by a Category 5 hurricane. And I was trying to piece all the pieces scattered to the winds back together so that people could keep their jobs and so on and so forth. And Ellen and I were struggling.
Yeah.
And I discovered underneath the addictive behavior actually a deeper rooted issue, and the issue of anger in my life.
Yeah.
That I'd really never properly dealt with. And my anger became cause enough for my wife to finally draw the line and said, I'm separating from you.
Yeah.
And really all hell broke loose in my life.
Yeah.
And I was forced to go deep.
Yeah.
And to deal with pain that I had long avoided.
Mm.
And some 5 months later, we reconciled.
Mm.
And we're still on a path of healing and restoration.
Yeah. And you guys still have kids at home?
We have 4 kids. I have an 18, 16, 14, and 12-year-old. 3 girls and one boy.
Mm-hmm. It's been tough. Recovery is not without its share of pain, is it?
I'm guessing that the absence of pain is something I will only discover on the other side of the Jordan.
Yeah.
But how did you say it the other night? Facing the death by the sword or by...
That's right. Avoiding beheading and meeting death by a thousand cuts.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of the choice. I mean,
yeah. It's you either face it,
right,
or it destroys you eventually. And
Jesus said, "You fall on the rock, or the rock falls on you. Your choice." Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know about you, but I wouldn't trade this life. My worst day in recovery, when I look at it from the point of view of eternal values and what really counts, my worst day in recovery is better than my best day as an active addict.
Well, you know, I remember the time when Ellen separated from me, and I gave her good reason to do so. But I remember describing that pain as more intense than anything I'd ever experienced. That you could take all the pain that I had experienced previously in 40 years of life, pile it up into a room, and it would not measure up to the pain that I was feeling.
Yeah.
And you might say, well, why would anyone choose that, to go to that place? I think it was there for the first time that I discovered God's grace and in the way that I now know it, where I rediscovered the gospel that God really, truly, he loves me in that state.
Yeah.
Even if no one else does.
Yeah.
Right.
And I found him, I found the safe refuge in Christ, and the pain forced me there.
Mm.
I don't know that I would have gone there were it not for the pain.
Yeah.
And the gospel's really, in the end, it's the only hope that we have. It is the truth that that God deliriously pursues us when we are the most naked, when we are the most ashamed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you think about, I said this the other night when we were talking about, or maybe I was talking to somebody else, I don't know, or I might have been dreaming, I don't know. But the story of the leper, when the leper fell at the feet of Christ, the reason that he did was because he was very much aware of his sickness and his disease and his need.
Yeah.
And what amazes me now as I look back on that story, after being familiar with it for so many years, is that no one else in that story thought to do the same thing as the leper.
Yeah.
Though all of us are in a state of need.
Yeah.
All of us are as desperate as the leper. We're all sick.
Yeah.
And so I'm thankful. I'm now at a point where I'm thankful for the pain.
Yeah.
And I would choose it over the absence of pain, because it drove me to the healing that can only be found at the feet of Christ.
Mm. And we'll be back on the Pirate Monk Podcast.
Out on the edge of the precipice, where no one will follow and few that will care. Deep the pulsation and throbbing the sound, the heart in his chest is beating him down. There is a story would give him a twitch, but never thought he would be found in the ditch. And never thought friends would abandon him there and leave without words or even a prayer. Beating his head on a figurative wall, trying to get up from a figurative fall. Under the skin internally bleeds, dark like the sin he insatiably feeds. There is a story would give him a twitch, but never thought he would be found in the ditch. And never thought friends would abandon him there and leave without words or even a prayer. Under the cloud of a terrible spell, he's not the first to descend to hell. Poisonous tears from an embittered face, darker the fears from a darkening place. But startled by light that broke from above, startled within by a vision of love.
Startled by light.
A ditch.
Mo, you've got not one CD, not two CDs, not three, not even four CDs. How many CDs do you have?
Well, it depends on how you count. But,
okay.
I have nine individual CDs. I did some other compilations and stuff with some other artists and what have you. But yeah, I have nine of my own.
Okay.
And me and Mondo are thinking about putting together one. That depends on what kind of price he gives me.
Mondo is the man. He'll deliver the Nashville sound.
All right. Well.
Yeah.
Well, so that'd be 10.
Yeah. That would be the 10th.
Okay. Like,
that would
all
be
right.
the 10th.
Now, for people who do not have access to the trunk of your car, how would they acquire said CDs?
Yeah, there are two different ways in which you can do that. You can go to our kind of web store called justiceroad.com.
Okay.
If you Google Mo Leverett, that will be the second option. The first one is my Rebirth International website. But the second way, and this is actually cheaper, I hate to say, if you go to iTunes, you can find me there too. Actually, now let me see it say that. The latest CD is on iTunes, but I can't afford to put all of them on there. So if you want all of the CDs or some of the older ones, you can go to justiceroad.com.
All right. We're going to have to see what we can do to get all that stuff on iTunes.
Bro. Yeah, just
for our listeners, let's spell your last name for some of the listeners.
Okay.
Just to make sure.
L-E-V-E-R-E-T-T. That would be Leverett.
There we go.
And how do we spell Mo? He's from Louisiana, so it could be M-E-A-U.
That's true. That's very true.
Yeah. No, it's M-O.
Just basically yeah. M-O.
All it's right. actually short for Morgan, which I'm thinking about dropping that name legally, but we'll see.
That's been co-opted by the female population.
It has. The women have taken it over. Morgan Freeman is our last stand. But, no, I've never been called anything other than Mo, so that's...
Okay.
There you go. Yeah.
All right. Well, before we go, let me remind our listeners of the upcoming 48 Hours of Frankness weekend in September. Beautiful fall weekend in the mountains of North Carolina at the Valley Cruces Conference Center. This is going to be a fabulous weekend. And, fellas, if you want an immersive experience to kind of get you jump-started on this way of life, if you want to... learn the path of the Samson, the path of the pirate monk. There's no better way to do it than to go to a 48 hours weekend. You'll go all the way through the path in 48 hours. It's an intensive weekend. You're not going to golf. You're not going to shoot skeet. You're not going to nap a lot, but you will make some great friends. Mm-hmm. And, you'll acquire some new tools for living.
You could stay longer and play golf.
I suppose you could. You could make it 48 hours of practice and 24 hours of recreation.
Yes. That's what I might do if I go.
Okay.
But there's no recreation during the 48 hours.
Right, okay.
Am I invited to come?
You are invited to come, and our other listeners, when they come,
okay, cool.
can stay an extra 24 hours and play golf with you.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
All right, if you're interested... go to the main page at samsonsociety.org. Look on the left-hand side under that events column and click on the link for the Fall 48 Hours of Frankness Retreat. Until next week, it's goodbye to those of us here at the Pirate Monk Podcast from samsonsociety.org.
Because my Lord has carried us on, and everybody say,
Sing it from your soul.
Oh yeah.
say to be all, me say you can be. When me tell you, say you go, you might go down, you must rise up. Me I tell you, yes, you know, shall we pull up your cup, brush yourself off, and try again.